be a team player. And if you can set out with that from day one, it's incredible. I have this phrase, which is, it's amazing what you can accomplish if you don't care who gets the credit.
Welcome to the Be Epic podcast, brought to you by the Sam M. Walton College of Business at the University of Arkansas. I'm your host, Brent Williams. Together, we'll explore the dynamic landscape of business and uncover the strategies, insights, and stories that drive business today.
Today, I have with me Judith McKenna. And Judith was recently retired as president and CEO of Walmart International, amongst many other things. But Judith, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me here today. I'm excited to spend the day with all of you and to learn more about the college.
Yeah, well, today, you know, in addition to the role I just mentioned, you recently joined the board of Unilever, mm-hmm. A wonderful company. And today you're serving as our executive in residence. So and invest in your time and our students. We're excited to have you here.
Thank you very much indeed. I'm looking forward to it.
I want to spend a little time today talking about retail, of course, and where retail is going. I think you've got a pretty unique vantage point of having run a global business across 19 countries, I believe, when you left Walmart a few months ago. So I want to spend some time digging into that. I want to dig into what you've learned along the way, which is, I'm sure, what you're going to be sharing with our students today. But maybe first, for our listeners, a little bit about your background. I think you have an accounting background as an undergraduate and started with KPMG, but I'll let you tell us more.
Well, actually, my undergraduate is law.
It is? Okay.
So I'm law, and then I went into accountancy while I figured out what I wanted to do and worked for KPMG. Discovered quite a truth early on that maths isn't my strong point, but still qualified. I am qualified, which, as you find the rest of the story, is mildly amusing. Went in from there and eventually joined a client which had been working at, which was Allied Domecq and something called the Tetley Pub Company, which is a brewing and pub owning business, which is utterly fascinating, incredibly traditional business, incredibly fascinating as your first role in industry, as you come out of a profession. Learned so much about people and what we did there. But then I moved. Actually, I lost my job. The company restructured. I was made redundant. I had a 9-month-old baby at the time. And I was like, what am I going to do? So, I don't know. And there was a business called Asda, which is one of the UK supermarkets, one of the biggest supermarkets in the UK. And they were literally across the road from where I'd been working. And the decision that I made to go there was I only need to do it for about a year in order to get my feet on the ground, because it's a bit of a shock to the system what had happened. And 27 years later, I'm still here. So don't ever take career advice from me about what to do. So I started at Asda.
I'll take advice on resiliency, though. How about that?
It's all part of it.
Yeah.
These journeys, I always describe them as almost the sliding door moments in life and in careers, and you choose your attitude as you move through those sliding doors, however it plays out. So I started running a really small team in the kind of accounting services department, and worked my way through there. And ultimately, Walmart came along and bought us. And we were like, oh, we were in the middle of another deal beforehand, and they came in and swooped Asda from that. Continued to work in finance. I eventually became the CFO, which is quite amusing if you think about my earlier comments about math may not be my strong point. Interesting point about finance. You have to be competent enough at the maths, but it's way more than that. And it's also massively about people as well. So I was a CFO for nearly a decade. But while I was doing that, I was the kind of person that said, oh, yes, so-and-so's left from this function. I'll run that for a while. So I ran HR for a while. I ran technology for a while. I ran supply chain for a bit. I did just about everything except merchandising there. And I even did a little bit of operations. We did a deal to buy some shops from a business called Netto. And we did all the due diligence. I did the diligence, the M&A and everything. We got to the end of that and I was like, I don't want somebody else to run this. So I said, can I run these stores? Because they're much different format to the ones we had. And they went, yeah, just for a while till we figure everything out, but you're not keeping them. I was like, okay. And then the chief operating officer opportunity came up. Been in finance, been a CFO for a decade, was kind of learning these kind of operating ropes. And I said, I'd stick my hand up and like, I'll do it. And they said, well, if you do this one, you have to give up finance. You can't do both. And I said, well, what's the worst that could happen? And I did it. And so I did chief operating officer for Asda for just under 3 years. And then I made the decision to come over to the US with Walmart for an experience, brought my family. I have two grown-up kids and my husband. And I came only for 2 years. I knew exactly when I was going home. I knew the dates the kids were going back into school. And that was it. No question about it. And I moved into international to be the head of strategy, M&A and business development in the international business. Real big challenge for me. But I'd only done it for about a year when Doug McMillon moved to be the CEO of Walmart Inc. And he said, would you mind coming into the US and having a quick look and seeing two things? One is we have neighborhood markets, which are really just starting to grow. Would you operate those for a period of time? And would you have a look at this intersection of digital and physical? We think there is something in the intersection. The word omnichannel hadn't even been created at that point. And I would tell you there was less of an intersection and more of two parallel paths at that stage that were running. So I started to do that. There was a whole pile of change again. Remember, my plan was to go home. I knew my date. And by a series of events, including the CEO of Walmart US changing, I ended up becoming the chief operating officer of Walmart US, which is 1.2 million people, 4,500 stores, and a small British accountant from the north of England. kind of running those. And it's the best job in the world. It was fantastic. Did that for about 3 years. Note, never got home back to the UK at this point.
We'd still abandoned, here, by the way.
Still here. We'd abandoned all hope of that completely. And I'm incredibly grateful for those opportunities and those moments, the sliding doors, that decisions worked out as we went through them. And then 6 years ago, just over six, nearly 7 years ago now, I became the CEO of Walmart International and operated that until my retirement on the 31st of January this year.
What a career thus far. And starting chapter two.
That's right.
It sounds like at this point. You know, Judith, I mean, what you just said, I can't remember exactly the way you said it, but, you know, when Doug McMillon assumes the CEO role and says, come over and, like, let's look at this intersection of digital and physical, that was a pretty historical moment. You may not have known it at the time, but my goodness.
Yeah, it was. I think it was clear. So in the UK, I had this advantage because in the UK, we'd operated online grocery shopping for a long time. It had taken us years to create a model that we thought could ultimately work. And we'd had a lot of failures along the way. But I ran the grocery, online grocery teams when I was chief operating officer over there. And I'd watched it grow up. And there was a real, I can remember the launch of grocery shopping right back, and it would have been like 8 or 9 years previous to all of that, probably longer. And I can remember the presentation that the lady, she was called Sheena Ford, who was making about why we should invest in online shopping. And it was a picture of a dinosaur on the front of this presentation. And it said, eat lunch or be lunch. Mm. And it's always stuck with me. Mm. And when we came to the US, I knew that the US was already looking. It got two stores. It was trying some things in. It had been to France. It had seen the French models of click drive-throughs and do that. And the rest really was just, actually, if we can make people work together and understand that this is not a bad thing, it's a good thing, and that everybody can play a part in it. So that transformation was as much about getting people's mindsets transformed as it ever was physically what we did. And that's at both ends, which was stores and people from that side of it saying, this is cannibalizing our business. Like, why would we do this? People are going to stop coming in shops. And then e-commerce folks saying, no, the world is going to be an online. We're not going to need the same number of stores and not going to operate the same way. As we now know, history is written and the sweet spot is in the middle. But we just started. We just started with online pickup. We didn't do delivery because myself and a guy called Mark Ibbotson had promised ourselves that if we ever got a chance to start over, he and I had worked on it in the UK, we would start with pickup and then move to delivery. Like, who in the world gets a chance to redo it all over again and at the world's largest retailer? So that is why pickup was the first thing we did, not delivery, until we built the muscle about how to pick. And then we could expand into delivery later.
Interesting.
That makes it sound like it was really easy and it was a really quick thing to do. It really wasn't. And it was like a ringside seat, actually being in the ring, not just the seat, to watching a business mind shift in terms of what was important and how you could get growth from this. And I'll tell you a funny aside story. Some people who know Walmarts around, not just locally, you'll know that when we very first started, there was big orange pickup signs on the corners of Walmarts. We painted them bright orange and it said pickup on them. People have often asked, like, you know, how did you think about the branding colour? How did you do that? For all of those students who are studying branding and how you have to be really thoughtful about it, you do. But in that particular case, we just wanted people to see it.
Yeah.
Because nobody knew what on earth it meant or what it was or where to go. So we painted them bright orange and hoped for the best. As it turns out, it worked out beautifully, but it's now so embedded, you don't need to do that anymore. You can just, it's just Walmart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when you said that, like, I can see the orange sign in my mind. And it's a reminder of sometimes things can be really simple.
That's right.
Hard, but simple.
That's exactly right.
Hmm. Well, as you've, you know, now experienced both U.S., U.K., U.S., and then global, and you've been there at a pretty historical moment and helped Walmart to really build out the way its omnichannel strategy and capabilities. What do you see changing now that interests you? You know, whether that's in pockets across the world or, anything about the way that you see retail and commerce changing.
Yeah, I think that what I love is I think everybody has accepted that the model is omni and that there is a place for stores in whatever that future looks like. Because people didn't always believe that. And I firmly have always believed it. And they're an incredible asset, if run correctly, when you're an online retailer as well. So I see that. I think there will be less in terms of the physical flow of what happens. It might be how you get your product will change in the future. So I think the work that Walmart is doing, for example, on drones is fascinating. That how does last mile continue to develop? Automated vehicles, drones, that is a fascinating area which could give even more access to people and working that. But I think what's really going to happen, and you've got quite a way into this without talking about AI and Gen AI, is how do retailers personalize in the future, show you things of interest to you without cutting you off from a breadth of display that you also want to be able to browse. And it's interesting when people shop online, as many people know, sometimes you go in to buy a product. You know what you want. And sometimes you just want to look. And the better that we get at doing those things, serving up experiences to people, I think it's going to be interesting. I do also think there is some trends coming through which will affect. So wellness, health, people want to know where products come from. What does that look like? I think that opens up a whole another set of opportunities as well in retail and supplies chains for retail. But I, when I look around the world, what I do get excited about in retail is product development. We talk about retail. We always talk about, you know, tech and how it's going to change it. Like, products and products around the world. So if you, I'll take one particular category. So if I look at the UK, what we would call ready meals, convenience food, is massive. It is a huge part of the shopping basket, way more underdeveloped in the US.
Mm-hmm.
Opportunity in those kind of areas. Mm-hmm. So I think product development is something that's really interesting as well.
Hmm. So products that excite customers. And then also, you know, one thing you said about the development of the omni experience is, well, using AI, generative AI potentially to better serve up to me what I need and want, it is still shopping, you know, and there's still some excitement in that.
Yeah. And I do upset some people when I say this. Fundamentally, we buy things, we move things, we show people things, we sell things. Everything else around that is the technology that enables a lot of that. Now, I do think as you start to serve up those personalized kind of experiences and everything else, the risk of that is data and trust. Because, you know, what people, and the people who get this right will be those who make me feel this is an experience, but I'm in no way, you know, my data isn't being used for something I wouldn't want it to be used for. I trust you with my data, and that relationship works for both of us. And that, I think, is going to be increasingly important as well.
Well, one thing I've noticed, Judith, that I feel like at least you do really well is you take really complicated things and actually make them a little simpler so that someone can get their head around them. How did you take that skill or other skills and now move from the U.S., from the U.K. to the U.S., and now all of a sudden, you know, you're managing a business that's in 19, 20 countries?
Yeah, I should probably not let you into the secret. One of the reasons I try to do that is I have to understand it. In business, as you come up, one of the things that's brilliant about it is you will get involved and engaged in things that you have no experience of. And that could be healthcare. It could be financial services, another big trends, that things that are happening. I can't pretend to be an expert. So for me to be able to understand that and make sure, is there the right guardrails? Are we thinking about this the right way? Should we make investments? I need for myself to be able to boil it down to what are the principles of this? And that concept of the principles of something, if you get to that, everything else is variants of that. And if there's a groundbreaking disruptive model that does something differently, understand what that is. And that is a universal skill, like anywhere. And there are people who do it even better than I do, that, you know, complex problems, and they explain it to me and go, oh, that's what you meant. And the translation, therefore, between the UK and the US was relatively straightforward from that. Although I think some people, when I came over, they would still say this if you talk to anybody, is I ask too many questions. Like, I am Mrs. Questions. And the reason for that is because that's how I understand. And as I process that information, I can then think about how I create models in my head for how things work. The biggest difference between moving from the UK to the US was the language. Like, completely divided by a common language. That was by far the hardest thing. And I grew up with American TV because we used to get all of the shows. I'm not going to tell you which ones because it'll age me horribly. But I had some of it. But some of my phraseology just didn't work here. Can you imagine standing on stage at the year beginning meeting for Walmart in front of all of their store managers, and I'm saying something and the whole of the audience is just looking at me like, we have no idea what you just said.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that doesn't translate at all.
That's funny.
Yeah.
I mean, it makes sense once you say it, but now, so you had to do that here. How do you do that across 19, 20 countries? I think earlier when we were talking, you said something about, you felt like one really important thing about running a global business, mm-hmm, is that, I don't know exactly how you said it, but you have to be local,
yeah,
in some way.
It's exactly that. And I'm passionate about this, which is, I believe the way to be successful locally, globally, is to think local. That doesn't mean you're not global. That doesn't mean that you can't bring all of the advantages of being global. There are some things that are non-negotiable, ethics and compliance and those areas that should be global. But how you understand the customer, that's a local customer. That's a local team. Now, I also believe that customers are more alike around the world than they are different. But once you have that as a central principle, that closest to the customer we have to be able to localize, the further up the pipe you go, the more global we should become. That actually gives you, for me, quite a good blueprint for how you operate a global business. The phrase I used in the strategy for Walmart International that I had was strong local businesses powered by Walmart. So for me, that is a business in a market that is independently strong in that market. It's close to its customer. It can take the right decisions. It knows its competition. It adapts to that. But the powered by Walmart means that it is actually, it has an advantage because it is part of the Walmart family, and Walmart gets something in return from that business as well. And that could be innovation sharing. The more that you can do the same, the better, undoubtedly. But you have to know where those lines are. So I'm a great believer in kind of a multi-local model in some ways. The biggest thing when you start to translate anything globally for me is culture. And you have to understand different cultures. You have to understand the nuances of those cultures. People generally want the same things. They have the same hopes, fears, and dreams. However, the context around them might be slightly different. So not going to a market and saying, here are all of the things I know and I believe. It's like, let me understand first. And then let's figure out how we get a bit of the best of both worlds mm-hmm. here to create that kind of local model mm-hmm. that's still global.
Is this where I think you called yourself a moment ago, Mrs. Questions?
Yes.
I assume that was a tremendous, if that's the way you think and the way you learn, I assume that was a tremendous advantage as you go into the market, spend time there, ask questions and listen. Is it that simple?
Yes. And by the way, that's no different than the US. So when I was running the US operations, it was the same thing. Walk stores, just ask questions, get people to tell you what was happening. And just, you know, the simplest question, what's happening in your day today? Hey, what's working well? Tell me, do you have any ideas how we could make this better? That's kind of a store conversation. But culturally, I can remember going into India, and I'd been much earlier in my career, and then went back when I went into the international role. And I, one of the things I said to the teams was, what would you recommend I read? And the teams, rather than me buying books here, the teams there gave me 3 or 4 books and said, read these if you want to even start to understand, which, by the way, you'll never be able to be there, but it will give you a grounding for it. And then I'd run some listening sessions, and I'd just get people to talk to me. And just tell me what you do. Tell me, how does family life to work life work? How do families behave at home? Tell me those things. And of course, everywhere's different. You know, it's a multitude of states there. Same thing, same as the US, actually. Like, everything's got its own rituals and kind of rhythm to it. You can't know it all, but you can know enough to be culturally adept and respectful. And I think respect is an incredibly important part of it.
Yeah, I've, you know, followed you on LinkedIn for some time, known about your career. And one thing I've noticed, or I think I've noticed, I hope I've interpreted this correctly, you're passionate about teams and
yes.
building teams that function at a high level. Maybe kind of where did that come from in you, and like any tips that you would have? Like, well, you know, I'm sure you've made some mistakes and had some great successes. What'd you learn from that?
I am passionate about teams. And I think it comes from a couple of different places. One is, I've worked in good teams and I've worked in bad teams. And the difference in those, you know, I'm one of these people, like, if I ever get to a place where I run a team, they're the things I won't do and they're the things I will do. So part of it was that. And then I enjoy seeing people develop. That's critical to me. And frankly, I can't do it on my own. Like, I'm not bright enough. There's not enough hours in the day. And there's always somebody that knows more than me and has a better idea than I do. So if you can get people to do the what they can do that you can't do, and you make it a relationship where everybody grows, then that's a win-win. And why wouldn't you? And maybe some of it, I haven't really thought about it this way, but maybe some of it comes back to the fact I'm not the best accountant in the world. Like, I'm not bad. I'm fine. But I'm never going to be a superstar at it. So you have to build a team with superstars in it. But they'll only be a superstar in your team and want to be in your team if you treat them well and the team is successful. So all of these threads start to come together. And life's too short to not have fun as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Life is too short not to have fun. And creating some fun and some energy means you go home yourself in a better place, as you hope everybody goes back in a better place as well. So the advice I would, you know, it's interesting when I break down advice, one of the things I always say is be a team player. Be a team player. And if you can set out with that from day one, it's incredible. I have this phrase, which is, it's amazing what you can accomplish if you don't care who gets the credit. And that is a mantra that I have tried to live by. Like, I will hopefully be the first to put somebody on a pedestal and say, look at what they did. They did a brilliant job with this. Like, in a meeting, you know, there's some where you've got to be careful as to who's in there. But the majority, like, listen to this person. Like, they're the ones who know this. Now, you're also their safety net as they're learning to do that. Because it's scary the first time you have to present something or do something. So I'm the first to have high expectations. And if you ask somebody for a list of my attributes, I'm sure high expectations would be on there. And I don't always get it right. Sometimes they're too, I don't think, I'm sorry, I'd correct that. I don't think you never have too higher expectations. How I bring people along is sometimes has been one of my weak spots that I've consistently had to work on. At the same time, making sure that you have a really diverse team that all understands their part in it mm-hmm. is critical.
And it's so fun to build a team like that, lead it, and then watch those people thrive, isn't it?
And it's great seeing your team here. And you're applying all of those same principles. We had some time together with your team, and there are smiles around the table. There's an energy about people. That matters.
It does matter. I totally agree. Well, we've touched a good bit on probably what is my final question, but I'll ask you if there's one other thing, maybe. So when you think about the Walton College, thousands of students here, most of them are young people that are about to start their first job. If you just had to give one piece of advice to that graduating senior from what you've learned, what would it be?
I'm always challenged when somebody says, give the one piece of advice. But I will try to follow the questions.
I'll give you two or three.
Well, thank you. I would have probably done them anyway, to be honest, but no.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, if there's... I'm going to get... Like, there is one basic thing that you're going to think is hilarious, which gets... Like, you have to work hard.
Yeah.
I can give you all of the advice in the world, but if you're not prepared to work hard, then that's one of the fundamentals of it. That doesn't mean you can't have free time. That doesn't mean you can't make choices in life. But you do have to really apply yourself to whatever it is that you do. Mm-hmm. The second thing that I would say is find something that brings you joy, that you can be passionate about. Mm-hmm. And that might not be your first job.
Yeah.
It could be your second or your third or your fourth. But you'll take experiences along the way as you do that. And it's not, when I talk about having things that find you find joy in, a job that you find joy in, I don't mean every day is going to be rainbows and sparkles. Like, that is not what I mean. You'll have bad days. You'll actually do jobs that are not right for you. I've had plenty of them along the way. But maybe you believe in what the company does. And you know you're getting experience and you can do that. So find passion and joy and energy from what it is you choose to do. And finally, be a student of whatever business it is. Sam Walton's famous line, be a student of the business. Used to tell everybody, the store managers that, everybody that. I believe that. And my natural curiosity, which would also be on the list of people's things that they said about me, means that I am always a student of whatever it is that I'm doing. And they're the best pieces. But, you know, what a future and opportunity in front of folks that are graduating from here. It's really exciting. My own son is about to graduate this year, and seeing that. And I want to say that the challenges that come with that and the stress that comes with that. Yep. So maybe one of the other things is be resilient.
Yeah.
You mentioned that word earlier. Be resilient. If it doesn't work out first time, there's a second time and a third time and a fourth time. Mm-hmm. Your resilience will see you through so much.
I'm so excited for these students and what the rest of their career is going to look like. But you're right. These careers in life isn't linear, right? And embrace that and take joy in it. But going back to your first point, work hard.
Yeah.
Well, Judith, thank you for being executive in residence today at the Sam M. Walton College of Business. Thank you for just giving your time to our students and teaching us and making us better.
No, thank you. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. I've enjoyed the conversation. And just, you know, huge good luck to everybody who is graduating or who is on their journey towards that. I wish you all good things for the future.
Thanks, Judith.
Thank you.
On behalf of the Walton College, thank you for joining us for this captivating conversation. To stay connected and never miss an episode, simply search for Be Epic on your preferred podcast service.